Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're getting all revved up for the holidays, as you know. So it's about time that we bring you some sweet thoughts.
Yeah, this is a desert program. I dessert program. And you'll discover not only the dessert program, but we did a little minor globetrotting in order to bring you people who are really, really good at this dessert business, which is something that we don't cook a lot, but we enjoy when we have.
I'm really so impressed with these books that we interviewed these people, the authors of, that I'm almost motivated to go in with get my little kitchen scale out and start baking.
There you go. That's good. That's good. And they promise it's really not all that difficult.
Yes.
I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. Some of it's read and sounded kind of complicated.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Ed with two D's.
Yeah.
Kimber and his patisserie made simple. He promises right there in the title it's
simple.
Yeah.
We should be quick to point out that Peter's native land is kind of big on desserts, to put it mildly. But it's still, I think, a remarkable achievement to have an Englishman with the unusual name of Ed with two D's actually conquer French patisserie and get an enormous amount of respect from the French patisserie makers in the process of doing that. So first of all, in today's program, here's Ed.
I'm sure glad I'm not on a diet or interested in diets, which I'm not, because I'm looking at this absolutely luscious book by Ed Kimber, Ed that is with two D's, called Patisserie Made Simple, From Macaron to Muffieux and More. It is luscious looking, and everything must taste good too. If you wrote it so that we could all make these, Ed, is that the idea?
It was. The idea was that I wanted to demystify French baking, which is often seen as impossible to do at home and fussy and difficult. And so I spent a year and a half simplifying recipes, trimming them down of elements, or reworking them entirely so that they were doable by the home baker without having to buy lots and lots of equipment that they would never use again, with ingredients you can easily find at the supermarket and make it approachable for the home baker. And it is a complicated book in part, but it's all achievable. Definitely, I think, to me, baking and making something pretty and delicious is always worth spending time on. I think it's one of life's great pleasures is eating and cooking. And I think if you want to do that properly, there's nothing wrong with spending a little bit of time to do it to your best ability.
Well, did you have some sort of art training as well? Because they're really artistic.
Thank you. No, I have a love of art, and I am a photography fan. I love to photograph things, especially food. But no, we have a really good team that work on the book, although the actual cakes themselves and the recipes themselves are all designed by me. But the feel of the book and the design of the book was a really great collaborative progress with a really amazing group of people. And so I think the look of the book is, it has a very beautiful look, and I'm extremely proud of it.
Well, I just love it. And, you know, people will find, although they're going to fall in love again with some French pastry classics, they're going to find some interesting twists that you give. The history is also interesting. Like, I didn't know that this opera cake was really a recent development.
Yeah, I mean, French baking, everyone assumes everything in there is ancient. But actually, French baking does evolve. It evolves very slowly, so they don't tend to jump on trends a lot. But they will evolve, and the opera is maybe a little bit more unique. The opera... because it was much newer, but it spread so quickly and has been adopted by so many bakeries around the world, and now just seems like it is a complete classic. If my memory serves me right, which it probably doesn't right now, it was from the 50s or maybe the 60s. But there's even newer ones, the Concorde, which is not as well known, but is well known in bakery circles in France. That was created to commemorate the inaugural flight of Concorde itself. And again, that is a classic of French baking. So, yeah, everyone assumes French baking is ancient, but they do evolve.
So you can add a new classic. That's possible.
Oh, absolutely.
Just better be good, yeah. I guess. The interesting...
Well, yeah, if you look to America and you look at Dominique Ansel, his Krona idea, which, you know, is such a simple idea, really, spreads so quickly, and I'm sure over the years will, maybe not in the same format, but will establish itself in a certain category. So I think if something's good, then it can spread very easily.
You know, we interviewed him, and, you know, you get a good recipe like that, and it makes so much splash, it can haunt you.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm sure it will haunt him. He'll have a Krona on his grave, I'm sure. Whereas I'm happily just, baking myself away.
No, it's really funny. This is a story that has a rather unusual beginning. Because this is a student of something else. I don't think in the book you actually say what you were studying at the time, but it certainly wasn't saving money, I guess. Because you got a jingle in your pocket at the University of Lancaster when you cashed your first tuition check.
Yeah.
And then decided you just had to go to France to eat some cake.
Kind of, yeah. I was studying politics. I have a degree in international relations, which is not very useful for my job. But I was studying that, and I was living in dorms. And we actually had three foreign students, actually from America, who had come to study for a term in the UK. And we were in my room, we were watching a film, I think, and we were just chatting about Paris. And I'd never been before, and one of the girls had never been before. And we kind of said, oh, we should go for a weekend. And I was, a little bit, let's say, naive and maybe a little bit unwise with my money. So we literally just, the morning after, we walked down to the travel office on campus and booked ourselves a trip to Paris. We did it cheaply. It wasn't like I spent my entire student loan. But we went to Paris for a few days, and that was where I first tried macarons from Pierre Hermé. I'd never even heard of Pierre Hermé back then.
Oh, wow.
And Pierre Hermé was definitely one of the people that really introduced me into how amazing French baking
Start with the be. Best,
It became
right?
an obsession.
Start
yeah,
with the best.
Exactly. He's still one of my favorites. I've been very lucky to meet him a few times. I'm also very lucky that Philippe Contacini, who runs another of Paris's best patisseries, La Patisserie de Rêve, which means pastry shop of dreams, he has not become a mentor, but I've met him maybe six times over the last few years, and we've struck up a friendship, and he seems to respect what I do, and gave me a wonderful quote for the book. He actually gave me an introduction to the book, a three-page introduction, but sadly we got it too late, so we could only put a sentence of it on the cover. Oh. But he wrote a beautiful thing about how much he loved the book, so I was
well,
very happy about that.
Well, it's a gorgeous book.
Well, you'll have to write another book, and then you can put it in there.
Now, it would be odd when the book is all about, the letter's all about French baking and patisserie, and clap it on another book, but I will do it.
Now, the interesting thing is that I don't know what your day job is, but I do know that in your spare time, apparently you sort of hauled off a few prizes, which suggests that you might actually be quite good at this.
I'm a professional full-time food writer and baker. So I write for the UK's leading food magazines, so BBC Good Food, Delicious Magazine, Jamie Magazine, Waitrose, as well as magazines and newspapers around the world. I run baking classes. I do some TV. So my job is completely and utterly food.
Now, how did you organize this book? I see the contents page, pastry, cakes, and desserts. I mean, what was in your head in terms of how you organized it?
I wanted to kind of give a really good overview of French baking. So I wanted to have, I mean, the book is called Patisserie, but we stretch the coverage of that word a little bit. Technically, if you look at the kind of classical traditions of that word, that wouldn't include croissants because that's a separate skill done normally right. by the boulangerie rather than patisserie. But we wanted to kind of cover the whole gamut of French baking and put it into categories that would be very easily understood. So we lumped some things together that are a little unusual maybe, but as a category it works really nicely. But really the aim was to give a really good overview of baking. The one thing I wanted to do was I wanted to have a chapter that included things that were a little bit more difficult to do, but also allowed you to stretch what you can do. So, but also it is that kind of, that patisserie that is high level and...
Now which one is that? Well, what do you think?
That's the, well, that's what I call the masterclass chapter.
Okay.
So that's the more complex things. You can still definitely do them, but they are more effort than the rest of the book.
Well, give us an
example.
They're
also the more impressive.
What would you pick out of that?
One of the things in there is it's based around the idea of a gâteau opera, but it was completely reworked to be white chocolate, matcha, black sesame, and lemon. And it is a beautiful, beautiful cake. Quite complicated, but when you break it down into its elements, we try to reduce how many elements would normally be in that sort of cake and given it a decoration that's doable, but it's absolutely delicious. It's a gorgeous cake. But again, it's one that takes a little bit more effort than, say, the lemon pound cake or the madeleine.
You know, this croquembouche that you have with the violets and everything. I mean, I've seen a million of these croquembouches. Nothing that looks like this. It's gorgeous.
Well, the croquembouche was an interesting one because I thought about how to simplify croquembouche for a long time because a croquembouche is always the same. It's always, you know, shoe buns with a filling and caramel to get all together. Yeah. And normally you use a metal cone. And the cone you obviously have to buy, and the cones are actually very expensive, and you only use them for a croquembouche, which is pointless for people at home, because how many times are they going to make a croquembouche? So I was thinking about what else you could use that you already have in your kitchen. And everybody has, you know, a Pyrex mixing bowl. Everybody has mixing bowls at home. And so we use the bowl in the same way that you would use, but you have it there already. So it's a different shape, it's a different form. And it's smaller, so it's easier to do, and it's less daunting to do at home. But actually, in some ways, it's more stylish than the traditional one because it has that alternative shape.
Now, let me understand. You take a classic, which, I mean, here you are with your Madeleines, okay? I mean, talk about a classic. Isn't it daunting to try to find? I'm sure you're looking for the very best recipe you could devise for a madeleine. How do you go about doing that?
The madeleine recipe is one that kind of evolved over time. Often the way I develop recipes is that I will look at its very core as how it's made. And with a madeleine, it's made in a very, very similar method to how a Genoise sponge is made, which is kind of the classic whipped fatless, or most of the time fatless sponge that the French use and is now used all over the place. It's the same basis of a jelly roll cake. It's, you know, the same basis of what we call a Swiss roll. And so I started playing with different versions. I mean, obviously the ratio of butter and eggs and things is very different. But I started playing with different ratios and I just tested it, you know, multiple times. And then I also started to research my favorite madeleine in Paris. I tried to research their recipe and found something that was claiming to be their recipe. And I looked at their technique and I took a tip about using high heat when it goes in the oven and then chilling the mold. The tin came from another friend of mine. And so it's kind of, I walk around with my ears wide open and I have notebooks with me at all times. Little things will get noted down my spot. But that one was tested many, many times.
I bet it was, yeah.
I was happy with it.
Did any Parisian pâtisserie actually throw you out for taking notes?
Thankfully, I never took notes in the shops, but I have been thrown out of pâtisseries for taking pictures before. The French are very, for some reason, they're very protective, and it's a little oddity that I've always never really understood. I used to work over here in the UK with a PR company doing events, and they once invited me to something else they were doing, and it was the opening of PMA's first London boutique. And I went along, and I, you know, said, "Oh, would you mind if I take a picture of the shop?" And they said, "You can take one picture, and also everybody in the shop has to leave." They wouldn't have any staff in the pictures, and there could be no customers in the shop. It was very strange.
Yeah.
And if you go to Paris and you go to Pierre Hermé and you ask, they will sometimes say no. If you're lucky, they will say you're allowed to take a maximum of two pictures. And that's very common. Many, many pâtisseries in Paris will either say no or will say you can take one or two pictures. And I don't understand it, to be honest. If you're trying to get ideas for your own pâtisserie back home, you can just buy the products and look at them. So I never understood the no-picture rule, but they're very protective.
Well, we found that in London in the...
Oh, Harrods.
Harrods.
Yeah, we almost got
garroted, actually, in Harrods trying to take a picture.
Well, we were trying... We wanted to take a picture in the food hall, and they stopped us from doing that. We did get a photograph in the room that has the Sphinx in it. the gold Sphinx. I did sneak one picture, just to thumb my nose at Harrods.
So thankfully, they seem to have relaxed a little bit.
After the psycho
left.
Yeah, you are now allowed to. You seem to be allowed to take pictures there now.
Well, maybe I have so many things to ask you here. There are things that are really popular that I don't quite understand. But you give a little history of the macaron and its transit, how it came to the United States to be a macaroon and get coconut, right? Or was that another book?
that's another book. But the macaron, I mean... I think one of the things I love about French baking is everything comes with a story. And macarons are, just like everything else, they have a story. And it's whether you believe them or not. Many recipes in France have multiple stories. It's said the macaron comes originally from Italy and came to France with Catherine de Medici when she married into French royalty. And she brought along with her French pastry chef, and he cooked a version of macarons. But also there's another story that macarons originate within France from two different places, and that's what is currently served in places like Bordeaux as ancient macarons, which is much more like the Italian amaretti. And I love that. I love that pastries seem to have travelled across Europe and changed and become different. But then the macaron changed again when a pastry chef decided, actually, we should sandwich two of these together and turn them into a cookie. And then again, I think it was in the 80s when Pierre Hermé was working at Lagerie, and he decided to take them from the classic four flavors of chocolate, coffee, vanilla, and lemon, and do something more with them. And he elevated them to another level, and then that spread everywhere else. And I love the fact that baking can have a history and can have a story, and I find it oddly, it's romantic, it's fascinating to me.
Well, I think this is a delight to read, and of course, if you're going to eat with your eyes, there are no calories involved, and congratulations on this. It's Ed with two D's, Kimber, Pâtisserie Made Simple, From Macaron to Millefeuille and More. Very good. Congratulations and much success with your book, Ed.
Thank you very much.
And now bake them for me.
No, the idea is you bake it yourself.
Yeah, I know. Thank you again.
And having had an Englishman talking about French patisserie, right after the break, we're going to have a
Frenchman talking about world
French, yeah. French patisserie and also world patisserie as well.
Right.
So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back, and as Peter hinted, we're going
to be... Was that a hint?
It was right, pulled out, right?
A little more than a hint.
Next up, we have Bernard Lawrence, who is French, and he has a day job as a flight attendant, which took him all over the world so he could actually sample all these pastries firsthand, and he wrote this wonderful book that takes you with him around the world. It's called... Baklava, from baklava to tart tartin, patisserie. No, that's it.
Do it again. I don't want to edit that. Do it again. What's the book called? Come on, sweetheart.
It's called baklava to tart tartin.
There you go. So there you go. So you can tell that. At least one of the desserts is not French.
Everybody wants us to make this phyllo dough, which is like Chinese water torture.
Well, this guy, Bernard says he likes making it. It's a lost art. So there you go. He must do that when he's up in the air. When you ring your flight attendant call button on one of Bernard's flights, don't expect him to come rushing because he's making phyllo dough. Here's his interview.
It's a pleasure talking to Bernard Lawrence. His book, Baklava to Tart Tatin, is by Flammarion, and it's a world tour in 110 dessert recipes. Now, Bernard, you have a blog that gets 2 million hits a month. Is that correct?
Yes, in France, and actually in French, because now I have my blog is being translated into English, but my traffic is really, really low now on my English blog. So the traffic, 2 million to 3 million hits a month, it's on my French blog.
Yeah, now you also speak close to fluent Portuguese, huh? Brazilian style.
Yes, I think I speak better Portuguese, Brazilian Portuguese, than English. I used to speak really well English 10 years ago, but I think it's a little bit rusty now and hesitating, always hesitating between English accent and American accent, so I have a weird accent.
Well, we in our house, we have Peter's from England, and here I am, American.
So. Yeah, I have the same problem. I always tell people I speak three languages, English, American, and Australian. And I butcher French so that I won't even begin to say any words to you in French. My French is so horrible.
Oh, I think it's not really. On peut parler français, if you want.
No. Anyhow, here we have this book, and I must preface this by saying I'm not sure we would actually be soulmates because you're really obsessive about recipes.
I am.
And I'm not. I'm broad brushstrokes, you know. That's why I'm not a baker. I'm just a cook throwing things in a pot. But is it true that you actually started working on recipes when you were 7 years old?
Of course, yes. I've always cooked. I started with my mother, and taught me how to make poached eggs, and actually it's really, really easy. And I was 6 to 7 years old, and when I was 13 or 14 years old, I was baking Quignamin, which is a very rich and buttery Brittany cake that we have here in French Brittany. And so I've always made experiments in the kitchen.
Amazing. Now, you say that you've become a recipe sleuth in order to produce this book for your fans.
Yeah, well, I've always had a dream to write cookbooks. I don't know why, but when I was a teenager, well, my friends were dreaming about becoming, I don't know, actors or doctors or anything, but my dream was to write cookbooks, and I had really no idea how to achieve this dream. So I really wanted to write this cookbook for also my fans on my blog, but especially for myself. I don't know if it was the question.
Well, it's okay. You gave me an answer.
Actually, I have a quick follow-up. As we say in the United States, what do you have a day job?
Do I have a day job?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a flight attendant.
Okay, great.
For a big airline in France. So that's why I have so many recipes from the whole world, actually.
Yeah. You know, you've organized this book according to location, right?
Yes. I have a chapter about European desserts, one about African and Middle Eastern, one about Americas, North and South, and one about Asia.
Yeah, I was
very pleased. And I've been in all those countries, and I've tried all the recipes in the, I don't know, for example, I went to Morocco, and I made gazelle horns with a grandmother in Morocco, and she really taught me how to make them. Or I had the dessert in Asia, and when I go back home, I spend hours or days trying to make the same recipe, and the same taste, and the same flavors and textures. So I spend a lot of time trying to make the same recipes at home.
You know, I never even knew that the Japanese were known for desserts until we interviewed an author of a book. The whole book is Japanese desserts. Do you know it?
No, I would love to read it.
It's called
I know mochi. I know really, I know some desserts, but I didn't know that you could write a cookbook about Japanese desserts.
She's not Japanese, but the book is called Kyoto, isn't it?
I think it's Kyoto.
Kyoto?
Yeah. And it, what is, she's Italian, I think.
And you can listen to her interview as well. It's in OTM Audio Archives, so you can actually listen to what she said as well. She was very nice.
She lived in Japan, but I never knew that they were, she said their desserts are fabulous.
Actually, they are, yes. When I go to Japan, I love Japan, and I love Japanese food, but I prefer to eat a big bowl of noodle soup or gyoza or sushi. But I had some desserts in Japan, but there are some streets in Tokyo where they have some pastry shops, but it's always made with rice flour or glutinous rice flour. So I really like them, but I couldn't make a whole book about Japanese dessert, but I would love to read this book, actually.
Oh, look it up. We have it on our bookshelf, too. Now, back to these. How did you select these? You cover all the major bases for the sort of iconic desserts, macaron to various, like strudel. What am I looking at? Your olive oil cake. I mean, how do you pronounce cannelle?
Cannelle.
Anyway, and then you have these Portuguese custard tarts, which are
pastel de nata.
Uh huh.
It's really, really good.
And we, Peter and I, were just talking about it. We had some there when we were in Portugal.
Right in Belém.
Belém, yes, of course.
But we can't remember that we like them all that much. I don't know why.
You don't like desserts, so start off anyway.
It's delicious. When you go to Belém and you have it's always at the perfect temperature. It's always warm, and it's crispy and creamy inside. It's delicious. Really, I'm a big fan of pastel de nata, and actually that's one of the hardest recipe I had to experiment, because I tried the pastel de Belém in next to Lisbon in Belém, and I spent maybe 6 months on the pastel de nata to get the right texture and flavors, and I made maybe 35 to 40 experiments in my kitchen to get it right, so it was really a big work, and
well,
the recipe that you have in my book, it's almost the same as the one you can experiment in Belém.
What makes them so tricky to bake?
So tricky. Well, actually, it's not very hard to make, but you have to get the proportions right, and that's the hard part. Once you have the recipe, it's really easy to make, but to find the recipe and the right proportions and the right amount of sugar and flour and milk and everything, that's the hard part. And for example, I spent a whole year on a single recipe in Paris, in France, on the gingerbread that we have in Paris. There is a cheese store, a fromagerie, in Paris, and they sell, I don't know why, but they have a gingerbread, and that's the most fabulous gingerbread I've ever had in my life. And I went crazy with this recipe. I made maybe more than 60 experiments in my kitchen, and actually now I have the recipe, but I spent a whole year on it. But once you have the right proportions and you have the recipe, it's really, really easy to make. The hard part is to get the proportions right.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, that's sort of the key to any baked good, is have the proportions right.
I think I'm a little bit crazy. I'm a bit obsessed with food. that's my passion. Actually, I have a very small kitchen, but I give cooking class in Paris, so I rent a place, a big professional kitchen, and I rented it for several weekends, on several weeks, and I made all my experiments in this kitchen. So I don't know. Every time I went to this place, I made maybe 10 to 15 experiments a day. So sometimes in one day, but usually I made 2-3 experiments, and that's how I work. But usually for the gingerbread, by example, it's in my kitchen, in my oven, and it's a mess during, well, a whole week or 2 weeks. You have gingerbread in all over my apartment. It's completely crazy. But I think you have to be obsessed with that to get some proportions right. But I like it's really, really not annoying, but it's a bit annoying when you know that you have the right ingredients, and all you need to know is the proportion, the DNA of the recipe, and you have everything in your cupboard, in your fridge. You have the milk, you have the sugar, you have the honey, and if you have the right proportion, you get exactly the recipe that you love, and that's the part I love. I'm always looking for the right proportions for any recipe I try. I hate secrets. When I eat something, I have to know how to make it at home.
Well, people they refuse to give you the recipe, or what?
Some of them gave me the recipes, but when somebody doesn't want to give me the recipe, then I'm going to spend a very long time in my kitchen, and then the hard work starts.
Well, you know, I happen to know, I worked on a cookbook, and there's an iconic recipe, a cookie recipe in the book that everybody loves, and they even steal them from the restaurant. And I know that they deliberately misled the readers of the cookbook by changing the ingredients and not really giving them the correct ingredients.
So these are macaroons, by the way.
Coconut
macaroons.
I think professionals don't want you to make macaroons, because I have cooking class every month. I teach my people how to make macaroons, and it's really, really easy to make. But when you read a recipe in a book, it seems really, really hard to make. You have to think about recipe maybe 5 days ahead. For the egg whites, you have to put them out of the fridge, and you have to separate the egg yolks from the whites. And I don't do that, and my recipe is really, really simple. But I think professional chefs, they don't want us to make macarons at home, because
right.
They want us to think it's really hard to make, but actually it's really, really easy. So if you follow my recipe, you'll see it's really easy, and the result is exactly what you have on the picture in my book, really.
Yeah.
And I made so many experiments that you are sure that the recipe that is in my book is the right recipe. That's the reason why I have so many people on my blog, because they know that I spend so much time on some recipes that the recipe I give on the blog is the right one. It's not a fake one. It's a real one.
Now, there's a wonderful patisserie and, I guess, prepared food shop in the Place Madeleine. In fact, there are actually two, and they face each other. One called, is it Florimonde, and the other called Ediard. And
you're talking about the macaron shop La Durée?
It's just a food shop. And I thought I'm trying to remember the name. It's famous all over Paris.
Fauchon?
Yeah.
Fauchon, that's
Fauchon,
it.
And you had a bad experience?
No, it was a wonderful experience. I mean,
I think Fauchon is really, really good, but it's very expensive.
It's a luxury shop.
And
isn't it really?
it's very, very expensive.
I know.
When you know how much you spend to make a macaron, I don't know, maybe it's going to cost me maybe 5 euros, $6 to make 40 macarons, and you're going to spend the same amount of money just maybe for two of them. So I prefer to bake them at home. And
I'm sure you do. Now, listeners, just in case you're wondering about the coverage here, I guess the America section, including the good old USA section, he's heavy on brownies.
Yeah.
I was very surprised when Peter's family visited us from England that they didn't have brownies there. So they had brownies every day here in the States.
I love brownies.
Now, you also say that American cheesecake is really excellent when compared to French cheesecake?
I think so. I think you have the best cheesecakes in USA. But in France, people don't know how to bake a cheesecake. But it's only very recently that we have Philadelphia cream cheese in supermarkets.
Oh, that's true, too.
Three years ago, we didn't have that. People didn't know about that. I go to USA very often as a flight attendant, so I know Philadelphia cream cheese for a very long time now, but in France, it's very recent that we have that.
Yeah,
now people, they know how to make a cheesecake, and you can see on French blogs many recipes, and actually really, really good recipes, and in some restaurants, now you start to see good cheesecakes also, but I'll still prefer to buy a cheesecake in USA, in Junior's in New York, for example.
Junior's.
I don't know if you like it, but in Junior's, I think they're quite good.
There's
or
a cookbook.
Cheesecake Factory, I like it also.
Junior's has a cookbook, you know, of its recipes.
I'm pretty sure that's not the recipe that you get in the shop, no?
I don't know, but they have a whole book on it.
Maybe next time I'll buy one.
Yeah, I wanted to know, I mean, how do you decide that your recipe is the definitive recipe for each of these splendid desserts? I take issue particularly with your pavlova recipe. Have you ever eaten pavlova in Australia?
Yes, I've been to Australia, and I had some pavlova there. But the first time I had a pavlova was in France, made by an Australian friend. And
she dropped it. Is that the one she dropped?
I really prayed not to eat that cake because it seemed really, really bad. And she dropped it on the floor, and no, she served it. She took a spoon and she put it on a plate, and it was horrible. That was my first experience with a pavlova. But next, after that, I had some in Australia because I have one of my best friends who lives in Australia, and I've had some other really, really good pavlovas, and now I'm a big fan of pavlovas. So.
But your recipe calls for a hard meringue, and in fact, the characteristic that makes a pavlova is a kind of a chewy interior.
If you make my recipe, it's a chewy interior.
Really?
I don't know if the translation is it says that it's hard, because if you make the recipe, it's hard outside and really chewy inside with a very soft cream on the top with vanilla beans.
Yeah,
it's really, really good.
Well, it's supposed to, you make it, shape it like a dome, and then it sinks. And then you got all that crackling on the top of it that's supposed to be there.
Let's not have a fight here.
Okay.
I'm
crazed over pavlova.
Let's not have a pavlova fight.
We've lost
the skill of making it. Anne used to make it when we lived in Australia, and it was good, and she's never been able to reproduce it here in the United States.
It's a matter of humidity, I think.
So she's not that much of an expert anyway, Bernard.
You're telling tales on me.
I am.
Well, you know, I could just see people rushing off to bake, Bernard, and especially with these photographs that show close-ups of this delectable sweets. Ray, I mean, it's just incredible. Who would resist even the most basic things, like the strudel looks fabulous to me. Well, I wish you well with this cookbook, and also wish you success with your sojourn in Brazil. That ought to be fun.
Thank you. Yes, it will be fun. I just came back from Brazil 2 weeks ago. I went there for 2 weeks of vacation. I love Brazil. Really, it's a really nice place.
Well, yes. I mean, it's going to be busy, though.
We love Paris. We haven't been to Brazil. We probably would love Brazil, too. But we love Paris. And one of these days, we'll have to make sure you're there on the ground instead of flying off somewhere. And we can say hello in person and have some gingerbread.
It would be really, really nice, and I would bring you to the best places in Paris I know, because there are some very good places that are not famous, and I'll bring you there.
Right. Well, Bernard, bonne chance with your book.
Thank you very much. It was really nice of you to ask me all these questions anyway.
Okay. Ciao. Bernard.
Ciao, bye-bye, thank you.
Bye.
Really amazing achievement, right?
Yes.
Amazing achievement to be able to learn how to cook all these wonderful desserts.
Yeah.
And all the more remarkable because it's not his real job.
And, well, it's getting to be his real job.
Getting to be his real job, yeah, sure is. And after the break, we'll get someone else who has a real job and a French connection, but now operating in San Francisco, California, right, sweetheart?
Amy, go ahead.
Amy, after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Talk about a wonderful circumstance of birth. How would you like to be born into the Guittard chocolate family? Well, Amy Guittard had just that wonderful experience, and she's now written a book revealing all of the family chocolate recipes.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is a chocolate company, not a dessert producer. But not surprisingly, I guess, since they do produce rather a lot of very fine chocolate, when they're cooking for themselves in the family, they make use of that, good use of that.
Well, yeah,
stuff.
I mean, the chefs just flock to this chocolate.
Right. We flock there ourselves.
Right.
Don't they have a stall in the furry building?
No.
In the furry market? In San Francisco? I mean, that's where they are anyway. They make their chocolate in San Francisco, although all the secrets for how to make it came from France. And the family cooks, I guess, using chocolate a la Française, somewhat, not unsurprisingly. But it's something that you can conquer because you can buy the product and go for it yourselves. So
you're thinking of Ricky Uchi.
Oh, there we go. Well, I get them all mixed up.
So, well, yeah, chocolate.
Okay. What can I tell you?
But this is a book that will get you salivating and maybe even get you into the kitchen baking. Here is Amy Guittard. Now is our chance to look behind the scenes here in one of our favorite chocolate companies, Guittard. I'm talking to Amy Guittard. What a lucky, lucky person you are, Amy. Fifth generation, growing up with all this chocolate, and with this great sense of family as well. Tell us a little bit about the company.
Yeah, so my great-great-grandfather founded Guittard in 1868. He came from France to San Francisco looking for gold, and he brought chocolate with him to trade for mining supplies. And when he got here, he realized that he was able to get a bit more money for the chocolate than he would pining for gold. So went back to France to kind of finesse his skill, and then came back to San Francisco and opened doors down right along the water where all the commodities were coming in, like coffees and teas and all that good stuff. And at the time, we were doing not just chocolate. We would do anything that you needed to grind, so coffee, spices, teas, and then chocolate. And then in 1906, after the big earthquake burned our factory down and a fair amount of San Francisco as well, when we rebuilt, that's when we consolidated down just to chocolate.
Your ancestor, he was in the chocolate business in France?
So, you know, I had to do a fair amount of research on kind of my family history and things for the book. And in so doing, I realized that his uncle had a chocolate factory. And so he wasn't necessarily in it, but his distant relatives were. So that just makes me wonder how many generations back we go. You know, we're five generations of chocolate makers in San Francisco, but, you know, perhaps six or seven even thinking about in, you know, looking back at our roots in France.
Oh, that's true.
Where was it in France, just out of interest?
I don't speak French, so I'm going to butcher the name, my pronunciation, but it's a little town called Tournus, T-O-U-R-N-U-S.
And where is it close to?
I've been told it's close to Burgundy.
Oh, so you've not been there.
Interesting. So it's inland. Yeah. The interesting thing, the reason I asked the question is that the chocolate trade in my country, England, was very much focused on the port city of Bristol.
And many of the founding families, for reasons I've never been able to figure out, were Quakers.
Yeah, that's Quaker, right.
And there were chocolate makers in other parts of England, but they were also Quakers.
Right, right.
And they were traders, shippers, before they were chocolate makers.
Right. It's such an interesting thing to think about, you know. I think about the history of guitar being right along that water and thinking about all those other commodity companies that were down there as well, and how different the city is now, obviously, 150 plus years later. But, you know, just that sort of energy and the influx of goods that were coming in is pretty impeccable.
Now, do you get a sense of when the family started to get interested in confections as well as just chocolate bars, or is it just something that was sort of always there?
Yeah, well, you know, we really do only make chocolate. We sell to people who then make confections, but most of our business is wholesale, so we just make a whole bunch of different types of chocolate and then send it to people who will then make it into a confection or make it into a chocolate bar or use it in a finished dessert. We've got so many different types of customers, and then we have a small consumer line that has baking chips, organic baking wafers, baking bars, and then new chocolate bars that we just came out with. So, but it's all just chocolate, and it's really celebrating the flavor of the beans. So,
but hold on a second. This book, was the proximate cause of this interview, is all about things made with chocolate. Are they family recipes, or are they recipes from the people you sell to, or are they both?
They're all, most of them are family recipes, and when I say family, I mean, we talk about family in terms of our family of employees, our direct family, media family, and then also our family of suppliers and customers and things like that. Most of the recipes in this particular book are from our family, immediate family or family of employees, and there's a really old recipe in there, actually, that's from my grandmother, but I've been told that it's been around for the family for a very, very long time, and it's that chocolate persimmon pudding cake, which is delicious. The original recipe actually called for it to be steamed, but there are steamed directions, but then there's also directions if you wanted to just bake it up. But, you know, each recipe has a story, and it was really fun to be able to dig into it, be able to share it.
Oh, I love that. I sort of got stuck in the brownie chapter.
Oh, yeah.
I look beyond that. But
you don't have brownies in England.
No, they don't.
Nuts about brownies. Yeah.
Well, they make lots of other silly things, like Bakewell tarts and other kinds of odd things which are not known around the world, which are peculiar to England. I mean, the same is true in Australia. Australia has a different tradition for making desserts.
Right.
And mostly consumes its chocolate in chocolate bars.
Yeah.
And you've branched out beyond that a long time ago.
Yeah, the brownie chapter is quite intriguing in that there, just with a couple different changes in your recipe, you can get totally different results. We have a cocoa brownie, which is made with cocoa powder, and then we also have a brownie that's made with unsweetened chocolate. And the unsweetened chocolate brownie is the very sort of fudgy texture, whereas the brownie with the cocoa powder is a little bit more cakey. So you're rightfully getting lost in that chapter, yeah. Given how much diversity there is. But
I want to mention that, you know, I've read a lot about chocolate, and I've been around chocolate for quite a long time, and I think I know the process really well. But you should be commended for absolutely simplifying and making very direct your explanations of all the terms for chocolate, all the processes involved in chocolate making. And you make it really, put it on an accessible level. And I think that's a valuable part of this book.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, chocolate is seemingly highly mechanized, and, you know, it is incredibly complicated process. But it's all about the personal touch, and it's all about the knowledge and being able to, you know, create it with an understanding of how different things make different results. And I appreciate hearing that, because it is a very complicated process. And, the goal in writing the book really is to give people the tools to be able to create simple recipes, to get a better understanding of how they can use chocolate in their recipes, and then be able to have a little bit of flexibility if they wanted to try and maybe experiment with making a few changes to their recipes, or, you know, just really give them the framework and the comfort level to start off and then be able to explore other ways, you know, as they get more comfortable.
And you have a recipe for yo-yos. I love that.
Yeah, that one's great. It's got like a little bit of a lemon zest in, you know, in the cream that's in the middle, which adds a really nice sort of bright note. So,
yeah, lemon buttercream.
Somehow or other, we got into a lot of desserts and candies. Was it around the time of the fancy food show?
I don't know.
We seem to got a lot of them, and chocolate bark, which I had not had before, was one that arrived in large quantity, and I proceeded to demolish it.
What was that?
Oh. Chocolate bark. But bark. I didn't realize it's actually a recognized version of chocolate.
Oh, sure.
Which is represented right here in the book.
Yeah, no, that's a great, and that's actually, that recipe there is great, but again, it's one of those things where you could maybe replace, maybe try a different nut, or, you know, just really experiment around, because once you understand the basics of creating it, you can have a little bit more flexibility and maybe try something more seasonal, and the more you understand the flavor notes in your chocolate that you're using, whether it's a single origin or, you know, Dutch product or something like that, you can really start to pair your flavor notes with it and have some fun in the kitchen.
Now, do you go on any of these trips looking at cocoa beans?
I do, yeah. I was just in Cote d'Ivoire a couple weeks ago, which is West Africa. It's right near Ghana. I'm constantly going, not constantly, but I go visit farms quite often. And there's so much that happens on the farm that imparts a certain flavor on the beans, and it's so important to have that sort of understanding and connection with that process. And, you know, when I was in West Africa, we were meeting with farmers and talking to them about some sustainability initiatives, but also kind of their post-harvest practices, their fermentation and their drying, because that is such a pivotal part in creating flavor. So it's great. I love going to Origin. It's never a dull moment.
Now, I noticed that, in fact, you think that good chocolate goes all the way back to how the trees are shaded while they're growing.
Oh yeah.
So you take this kind of rather seriously.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I've been in the family business for about 4 years, and there's so much more for me to learn. You know, I go on these trips and I ask a ton of questions, because these are the folks who know the most about, you know, when do you prune a tree and why do you prune a tree, and, you know, what sort of shade trees do you need to plant in order to, you know, provide enough shade for the tree up until a certain point. So there's so much dialogue that needs to happen, and with that sort of collaboration throughout the supply chain is really how you can create kind of a sustainable source. And we're always looking at finding high quality beans. We get samples of beans from all over the world that we'll taste and sample and work with farmers to finesse their flavor profile so we can, you know, get it to a place where we can use it. It's such a fun process, and reminding ourselves that it is really truly a creative process in, you know, sourcing the beans, cultivating the beans, first of all, sourcing the beans, bringing them in and creating this beautiful product that is chocolate, and then being able to hand that off to a pastry chef or confectioner who can then bring that to life in a whole new way. So
the good news, listeners, is that this book will allow you to be a chocoholic 7 days a week, 365 days a year, because there's so much immense variety. Now, there isn't a lot, however, of savory, unless I missed something. Most about as bitter as it gets is bitter chocolate.
Oh, no, definitely no savory. It's all sweet. Definitely. We went the sweet route for this book, for sure. But, you know, we have a pastry chef on staff. His name's Donald Russell, and he does an amazing dinner that's all chocolate, and he's got savory, and he's got sweet, and he's using white chocolate to make, dishes, and it's impeccable what he can do. But this book is strictly sweets, which is great for me because I've got a giant sweet tooth.
Good.
Well, you were born with that. That's the 46th gene, I guess. As far as the guitar is concerned, or maybe it's the 47th.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be interesting listening to your your family's conversations at the holiday time.
Yeah.
Do you talk about anything besides chocolate?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, I work with my dad, so he and I are always talking about chocolate, whether we're, you know, at a family dinner table, you know, having dinner with the family or on a business trip together. It doesn't really stop, but I think that's what happens when you're passionate about what you do.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today all the way from San Francisco. We wish you well for the next five generations and more of guitar. He's not going away anytime soon, I don't think.
But Amy, you need to study French, for God's sake.
I know, I definitely do. You know, I've got a little thing on my phone to try and teach me, but I speak Spanish rather fluently, and the language, the accent is so darn different. So, baby steps.
Okay, dear. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Have a great one.
Stay well. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
How about that? A whole program about desserts, and we didn't put on a single pound.
Right. I'd like to have a holiday house party and have these three authors come and make desserts for us.
Well, yeah, I know you have a place in mind to have it as well, but we can't give away that little secret just yet. But watch his space and further developments. You never know what we might get up to and where our desserts might be served. And in the meantime, we hope that you'll enjoy your week, that you'll join us again same time, same place next Sunday. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.